In our culture, we're surrounded by this whole notion of falling in love, by a whole notion of infatuation. But you know, falling in love and infatuation is a drug. In fact, it's a dangerous drug. And like with any other dangerous drug, we need to know what we're dealing with.
This is Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. In the last several programs, Dr. Jack Crabtree and marriage and family therapist Christine Barber have been discussing the topic of singleness. Today, Jack and Christine continue their conversation by looking at romance and infatuation. The feelings associated with falling in love are some of the most powerful feelings in human experience. But how important are such feelings? Do not some people seek out those feelings as though they were a drug? Can they be a trap? And do they have a purpose in God's universe? Let's listen.
I'm thinking of a time, Jack, as a young adult, when I saw this young man, and I really, really wanted to get to know him. And as it turned out, I had the opportunity to get to know him. And that just started me out on 100-mile-an-hour drive toward relationship with him. I was totally and completely infatuated with him. I loved what he looked like, I loved what he acted like, I loved where he was headed, and it seemed to me at that point in my life that he was filling up everything for me. That's kind of how we work toward being in relationships. We get really involved and really excited and really immersed in another person as though they're going to fill up all our needs.
So are you saying you fell in love with him? Is that what you're
saying? Oh, I think I would have said at the time I was really in love with him. Head over heels for him.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something we need to talk about, is the whole phenomenon of falling in love or being in love. We live in a culture that is crazy, is obsessed with love in the sense of that feeling that we get where we are in love with someone or we have fallen in love with someone. I won't deny for a second that it's a very real phenomenon, but what I would challenge is that there is much of substance to the phenomenon, and that's the mistake that we have made in our culture, and we as Christians make the same mistake. We mistake it for something substantive and something that we can lay down as the foundation for a lifelong commitment in marriage. It's not that. I think it has a role to play, and we can talk about that, but its role is rather temporary, rather provisional, and rather iffy. So, yeah, we need to come to terms with what is that phenomenon. I would call it, one word we could use to describe falling in love, or what we call being in love, is infatuation. I realize that in calling it that, I risk being misunderstood, because I think, again, in our culture, people have the concept of infatuation as something that happens when you're 14 or 15 years old. It's a kind of naive, unsophisticated, innocent kind of encounter with being attracted to a person of the opposite sex. And it really is not very savvy. It really doesn't know much about life. And it's pretty innocent and pretty naive. And that's what they think of as infatuation. When you're 25 or 30 or 35 or 40, you're much more hip and sophisticated now, and you're no longer infatuated. Now you're in love, and it's true love, and it's real love, and you have a realistic view of life, and you've been around the block a few times, and you know what you're doing. You meet someone, and now you're in love. I would argue it's the same thing happening. Granted, it's more sophisticated when you're older. And granted, you're not as naive and not quite as innocent.
Or may not be quite as obvious about it.
And may not be as obvious about it. Yeah, may not be as silly about it. But I think fundamentally it's the same phenomenon. And we have to recognize what that phenomenon is and what's going on. What I mean is, the one who really helped me was Plato, actually.
You sound like a philosopher, Jack.
Yeah. One of his dialogues, I was just astounded. He's talking about, in that dialogue, he's talking about actually a homosexual relationship. But as he describes the relationship of the lover for the beloved in that dialogue, I thought, yes, he's put his finger on exactly the experience that I have had that everyone around me has, and it's the experience that all of our rock and roll songs are talking about. It's the experience that all of our movies are trying to explore at one level or another. We have this thing happen to us. I mean, the old classical myth is Cupid shooting its arrow and shooting me with it, and I get struck by the arrow of Cupid. I fall in love. And we have this sense that beyond my control, all of a sudden, all of my attention, all of my desire, all of my kindness, all of my nobility is directed toward this other person. And we get this feeling, and I think we need to recognize that it is a feeling that we're talking about. We get this feeling that is a euphoric feeling. It's one of the best feelings in the world. We get this feeling that I would die for the other person, that I want nothing but the best for the other person. I get this feeling that this feeling will never die, that this feeling will go on forever. I feel that...
I want to be with you. I never wanted to be apart from you. Everything that you do is wonderful. I think you're great. I can't find your faults. I can't see your shortcomings. Being committed to you would be no problem at all. We can work through anything with ease because of this feeling.
I feel that I need you, that I can't live without you. I can't stand being absent from you. It tears me apart when I'm not with you. Yeah.
We're calling it a feeling. You're not calling it a feeling in the sense that it doesn't really exist. You're saying it really does exist. It exists, though, only as a feeling.
Right. The problem is, unlike the commitment of marriage, although I feel like I want nothing but the best for you, it's just a feeling. What happens is it makes it easy for me to be kind, for me to be giving, for me to be generous, for me to be charitable. It makes it easy because it feels good to be that way. There's this merging of my feelings where it brings out of me, it draws out of me really noble stuff, really good stuff out of me. But my nobility and my generosity and my kindness only goes so far as my feeling goes. When the feeling stops, there's nothing there to make me be kind and generous any longer. That's why we get this crazy thing that happens in our life, in our experience, where in January, I am giving you the moon, and I'm being incredibly kind and incredibly generous, and in February, I'm saying, I don't love you anymore, go away, I can't stand you,
leave me alone. Why are you suffocating me?
Exactly. What a crazy, crazy thing. And yet it's because in January I had that feeling, in February the feeling is gone. The feeling, it's universal human experience, it seems to me, is that feeling is not permanent. It is only a temporary state of consciousness that I find myself in with respect to any relationships. Sometimes by nurturing it, we can kind of extend it for months. Maybe even years at times, if we really work at it and feed that feeling and cultivate that feeling, then we can make it last for a while. But in the end, life and reality comes crashing in on me, and I can't do it. I don't have the wherewithal to maintain that feeling forever. So we have all of our rock and roll songs saying, I've lost that loving feeling. Help me. But I mean, there's all
the
these,
wrong person to ask about.
There's all these lyrics that you hear beamed at you day in and day out, all day long, describing the experience of, I don't have that loving feeling anymore. I don't have the same feeling toward you that I used to have. And we either draw the conclusion that, well, I guess I married the wrong person. I guess I better look for the one who's the true love of my life, or I need to work at getting that loving feeling back. If you can't be with the one you love, then love the one you're with. I mean, we just have these crazy attitudes that we take toward our relationships with the opposite sex that all revolve around whatever else is true. It's absolutely essential that I have that feeling toward the other person.
Mm-hmm.
That's what life is all about. That's what sexuality is all about. That's what marriage is all about. That's what the other sex is all about, as far as our culture is concerned. And I think it is naive, it's foolish, it's idiotic of us to put that much stock in this feeling that I believe is God-given. I believe it has a role to play in our life and our experience, but it was intended by God to be a feeling that came, I felt intensely, and then faded with the expectation that something else would take over when it was gone. What would take over? Commitment. That the purpose of infatuation, of love, of eros is the Greek term for it, that the purpose of eros was to bring me to a point of being able and willing to make a commitment. Having made the commitment, the eros would fade, but the commitment that I've made would drive my relationship with the person from then on. That's real, true sophistication. That's real, true adult, grown-up attitude toward sexuality, is my recognition that it is foolish, it is futile, it is childish, it is adolescent, it is immature of me to strive to get back to my original feelings of romance and eros. The adult view, it seems to me, is the recognition that real life is about a commitment, a marriage commitment between a man and a woman, and the feelings will not be there, but the substance of what those feelings were all about will take over. The feelings were a mere bubble that pops compared to the profound and deep substance of what a marriage commitment is.
Jack and Christine will return in a moment. Almost 20 years ago, the Mackenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon, was created as a place where people could come and seriously think about their faith. Over the years, Mackenzie has grown in different directions and gone through various changes, but one thing has remained constant: a passionate love of God's Word and the truth it contains. The Mackenzie staff is dedicated to studying and understanding the Bible. Individually, they want to know what the biblical authors meant when they wrote the Bible. They want to peel away layers of false teaching and get to the very heart of the biblical message. And this is not easy. It's hard work. It requires years of dedication and the willingness to believe what the Bible actually says rather than what they might want it to say. These men and women also believe their studies and their teaching are not perfect. They know their understanding is limited, and they may be wrong, but they trust God to give them the eyes to clearly see His truth. They also encourage others to join them in their efforts, to ask them tough questions, to challenge their conclusions, and to take the Bible seriously. More importantly, they desire that all may come to the wonderful saving truth of the gospel. Much of the teaching done at Mackenzie is available on tape and can be ordered from the tape catalog. Papers, the free monthly newsletter, News and Views, are also available. Information about how you can find out more about Mackenzie Study Center and its ministries will be given at the end of today's program. Now, let's return to Jack and Christine.
Prior to the break, Jack, you were saying that what we do is really work toward maintaining this sense of being in love, kind of the feeling, strong feeling of infatuation. Whether we're young people, adolescents, or whether we're adults, we really want that feeling. It's really very much of a good feeling. It motivates us toward really wanting to be with another person and giving to them in really exceptional ways. When that feeling fades, we usually don't want to give that up. We try to extend it. Unless, of course, there's somebody on the horizon that we think we might be able to do it better with. And in that case, we can dump that person pretty easily and go on. But if there's no one else on the horizon, and if I feel like, boy, I've got somebody here that I better hold on to, then what I do is I try to nurture my sense of infatuation, both in myself and with the other person. For a few minutes, let's take some time to look at how I might be nurturing that sense of infatuation with another person, how I might try and milk that. What's it look like? I was thinking that one of the ways that I can do that is I can be over-involved in an emotional way with that person without really having a commitment to them having really thought it out, that I really want and am willing to have their best interest at heart, to really care about them in the way that commitment would ask me to. But I'm nurturing that relationship, that infatuation with them, by overextending myself to them emotionally, telling them things that would make them think that I'm really more with them than I truly am.
Yeah, okay. So that's how I'm nurturing that relationship, by trying to feed their infatuation and their love for me.
Right.
Is it right?
Right.
Yeah. And I think we also...
I might say, for example, I love you. Mm-hmm. You're the most important person in my life. I don't know how I could live without you. I'm expressing all these things that I'm kind of feeling at the time, but they aren't really based on a commitment that I have toward their best interest.
Yeah, precisely. And some people are very good at playing another person like an instrument. I mean, they know exactly what to say to elicit out of them these feelings of love. And that can be range anywhere from being relatively innocuous and relatively innocent in that they don't exploit it, to being incredibly exploitive. There are men out there who want sex, and that's all they want is sex, but they know that in order to get sex, they need to make that person love them. So they say what they need to say to create that feeling in them and make them vulnerable, make them willing. The other thing that we do, though, is not... You're absolutely right, that there's a way that we can feed, induce love in the other person toward me, but sometimes we, and just as importantly, we feed that feeling of love in myself. I as I see my love for the other person fading, I go, whoops, this is not working, it doesn't feel good not to be in love with them, I need to love them, and we have strategies that we use to really feed my own feelings of love. And fundamentally, I think what we do is that we lie to ourselves about who that person is. We tell ourselves a story, completely out of touch with the reality of who the person is. We imagine, we daydream about the virtues and the traits of that other person.
We kind of make up that person.
Exactly. We make them up. We create them in the image of somebody who really is my dreamboat. And tell ourselves that other person is that person so that we can love them.
And then what I do perhaps is, in order for my made-up person to fit with reality, I try to control them to be the person that I want them to be.
Yeah.
I don't give them the freedom to express what they want. If I like sailing, then I make them into people that like sailing, and I somehow perhaps intimidate them by sarcasm or put-downs or rejection if they don't also want to go sailing with me.
Right. Exactly.
It seems to me that another way that we really try and nurture this sense of infatuation is through romance. We might read romance novels together. We may go to romantic movies together. We may do a lot of candlelight dinners and things that would evoke some kind of an emotional, sensual experience with one another.
Yeah, and our circumstances, our environment can be very powerful in that regard. And we know that, and we sense that, even if we've never articulated it to ourselves. We intuitively know how to put ourselves in an environment that will be conducive to fostering romance. Exactly.
Earlier, Jack, you said that when I'm talking to a person about how much I love them and really telling them I'm much more emotionally connected to them than I really am, what I'm doing is I'm trying to get them to love me and to nurture our infatuation that way. But it also goes the other way, because if they're telling me that in response how much they love me, then what I'm doing is I'm getting this circular kind of reaction.
Yeah.
That I tell them how wonderful they are, they tell me how wonderful I am, and so we've got kind of this heightened sense of emotional closeness with one another.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's ultimately very... It's very self-indulgent. That's the very nature of Eros. Is what is so fascinating to us about it is that it feels so good. I mean, as I said earlier, there really is no better feeling in the world than the feeling of being in love.
And that is certainly the motivation for it.
Yeah, because whatever we can do to get that feeling in us, that's what we're after. That's what we want.
It's like if you're on a football team, it's total offense. You're scoring all the way, or feeling like you're scoring all the way.
Yeah.
There's not this defensive sense of when you're really in the height of infatuation of avoiding rejection or avoiding a sense of aloneness or avoiding my own insecurity or avoiding my own fears, I don't have that sense when I'm really heavily infatuated. I just feel this ongoing, building, offensive growth of a feeling that is just so powerful, and it just takes me away.
I have often described this feeling as a drug, and I really think that that's essentially what it is. It's a God-given, organic, hallucinogenic drug, because infatuation is a kind of hallucination. I'm kind of seeing things that aren't really there. And what I mean by that is, and the reason I say it's God-given is because I really think it is this hallucination that it creates in me is is kind of a window into what could be a reality. Notice how we were describing earlier the nature of the feeling. I feel like this feeling is going to last forever. Well, what is the marriage commitment? The marriage commitment is a lifelong commitment. I feel like I want nothing but the best for the person that I'm infatuated with. What is the marriage commitment? A marriage commitment is committing myself morally to take it on as a moral responsibility and as a duty to do right, to do good to my marriage partner, to promote everything good in their life and to resist everything bad and destructive and evil in their life. I'm making that kind of commitment to them. In infatuation, I feel like the other person matters and I don't matter. What's the nature of the marriage commitment? To put the other person's interests and well-being above my own. And you could go right down the line. Everything that we could describe about how the infatuation feels, there's a corresponding reality in the marriage commitment that very closely corresponds to that feeling. In other words, I think the substance of what a marriage commitment is kind of foreshadowed and reflected in how we feel when we feel in love with someone. I don't think that's an accident. I think God is in basically allowing us to, or creating in us this feeling, this state of consciousness that kind of, that gives us a vision for what marriage is and what my commitment to that person could be. God never intended that hallucination to last forever and to be the substance nor even the foundation of my marriage. He intended it to simply get me in a position where I might be willing to do what otherwise none of us in our right mind would ever do. I'm being facetious partly, but marriage is a scary thing if we take it seriously. And the prospect of committing myself for my whole life to do something that's going to be maybe very painful and hard and involve grief and suffering, and I'm going to deliberately, voluntarily get myself into that and put myself second and the other first, and everything that it is so counterintuitive, it is so counter everything that comes naturally to us in our natural selfishness. What gets us over the hurdle to be willing to do that? I think one of the things that God built into our experience to help us do that is this phenomenon of falling in love, eros, infatuation, romance.
So it kind of helps me not see the reality of what's going to be happening in my marriage?
Well, it mutes it. Yeah, it mutes my vision of the suffering that will be entailed and enhances and amplifies the beauty and nobility and glory of the good things of marriage. It exaggerates them in a way to really catch my attention and make me interested, I think. Now, I'm speaking not as an anthropologist who knows anything about human culture. Maybe an anthropologist could convince me that this is not a universal human experience. Maybe they could. I think that's unlikely. It just seems to me that it is too much a part of who we are and who I am as a human being, not just as an American, but as a human being, to dismiss it as just a part of our culture. I think it's probably built in, God-given, and universal among human beings. Different cultures do different things with it, and our culture you know, has raised it to the pinnacle of what life is all about. Other cultures, I'm sure, have not done that. They've been more sober in that respect. But regardless of what different cultures do with it, I find it hard to believe that it's not a universal human phenomenon that God has actually built into our experience. What I am advocating is that we have a sober, sane, realistic, mature attitude toward it. It's there, it's a reality, but what are we going to do with it? And what I say is, let's let it happen, let's let it disappear, let's let it evaporate, let's let it die, and then get on with what marriage is supposed to be all about. Let's not take this crazy attitude that we need to go back to my earlier life experience where I had that feeling and insist that I have that feeling again. It was fun while it lasted, it was beautiful while it lasted, and that was all well and good, but it's not the substance of what my life is all about. And I could live my whole life and never have that feeling and have not really lost anything of any substance and significance.
It seems to me the way that we usually try and get back to that is we get rid of the person we're with now that is I'm not feeling that way with, because I can't keep nurturing it. I can't kind of squeeze it out of this relationship, and I go on to a new relationship. Mm-hmm. Even if I marry Chuck, I may well stay married in a contractual agreement with another person, but I might be having affairs, either emotionally and or physically, with another person that I feel this with.
Exactly.
As a counselor, I see that forever and ever and ever. It's happening all the time, where people are saying they're married to one person, but they're actually developing and nurturing infatuations with other people.
And we feel justified in it, in at least in our culture, because this whole emphasis on love. See, in our culture, love is intrinsically self-justifying. Who could oppose love? Who could be against love? How could love be wrong? Another lyric to a song, how could anything that feels so good be so wrong?
Well, you're not talking about love, you're talking about feeling.
Infatuation, exactly.
And what we're defining love is as infatuation, we're not using those words because we're too mature usually to say that.
Exactly.
Not really mature, but I'm being facetious.
Right.
And I should be able to have this kind of love, this kind of feeling. That's the right thing. That's the good thing. Why would I ever have to deprive myself of something like that? Why should I say in something that's difficult or mundane or includes suffering when over here I could have something that really makes me feel great?
Exactly. So never mind, it may be adultery, you know, maybe legally and formally and technically it's adultery, but don't you dare call it wrong because I love them.
Right.
That's our attitude. That's our right. Cultural attitude.
I was so refreshed by in talking to a man recently who was telling me about an infatuation that he had for a few different women and women that he's had throughout his life, and saying to me, that's adultery. It felt, I mean, he knew it was wrong. He knew he needed to change his emphasis and his sight, but he didn't change what it was really about. He didn't say, well, you know, I'm just really in love with them. He said, you know, this is adultery. It's not it's not right to do to my wife, and I need to make a change. I need to turn the other direction. But that's really rare. I don't see that very much. In fact, I kind of fell out of my seat when he said it.
Mm-hmm.
He called it so clearly. Usually I'm saying, you know, that's adultery. And people are fighting me, angry with me, leaving counseling, upset because I'm telling them the truth about their life.
Mm-hmm. If I could correct his view a little bit, though, he may very well have been right in assessing his own situation, but I think it's important not to call infatuation merely in and of itself adultery, because that gives it too much substance. That gives it too much credit. Let me explain what I mean. If I'm just going through my life married to my wife, and another woman comes along who, for some strange reason, there's that sense of intrigue. All of a sudden, my imagination is captured by this person, and you have the beginning stages of this thing called love, of falling in love with them. If I at that point stop and tell myself, Jack, you've been here before, you know what this is. This is this strange little chemistry that happens that has nothing to do with anything anymore. it used to maybe have a role to play. It could get you interested in possibly making a commitment to that woman. You're already committed, Jack. It's completely irrelevant that you have this, that this chemistry is happening toward this woman. So forget it. Drop it. Don't do anything. Don't act in any way on it. And what I mean by don't act on it, don't behave in any way toward that woman as controlled by that. And don't do anything in your head. Don't do any head trips on yourself because of this. Because we can do that. You know, we can just sort of secretly carry on an affair where I'm nurturing this feeling of love for that person and I may never even talk to them. Mm-hmm. I may never interact with them because that would be too dangerous. But I don't dare want to allow this feeling to die because I like that feeling. If I can confront that chemistry and let it die, not do anything with it, not keep it alive, let it evaporate into space, I haven't committed adultery just because the chemistry happened.
Okay. Yeah. Really, really, really good clarification. I very much agree with you. Because that chemistry does happen to all of us. In our last program, we were saying, gosh, when we get married, it doesn't mean that we stop feeling that for other people or that we stop being attracted to other people. It's just what we do with it.
Yeah.
And what this person did with it was really nurture a relationship, both in his head and in ways that maybe nobody ever would know, but going to the place of their work more often, having more business meetings, getting involved with them in ways that looked legitimate, but that really weren't, and very much had this relationship going on a level that was pretty dangerous to his relationship with his wife and his commitment.
Then he's right. That is adultery. He's right then. Yeah.
So, you're thinking of sending your kid to college, or do you want to attend yourself? Before making your decision, be sure to ask this question. What is college for? For some, college is the rite of passage from youth to adulthood. For others, it's a stepping stone to a good job. Gutenberg College believes education should be a doorway to a good life. Then you might wisely ask, what is a good life? The Gutenberg College faculty and staff are committed to the conviction that living the good life is rooted in wisdom and character. Admittedly, Gutenberg is not for everyone. But if you are interested in reading and discussing the greatest thinkers, philosophers, poets, and theologians of Western civilization, if you are interested in working personally with your teachers, if you want to open the doorway to a good life, there is not a better education opportunity offered in the Northwest than Gutenberg College. Most members of the Gutenberg faculty also teach at McKenzie Study Center. McKenzie was founded on the belief that a clear understanding of God's Word is more than an intellectual exercise, that the Bible has a radical message for every human being. At McKenzie, you can find classes, seminars, conferences, counseling, tapes and articles, all focused toward knowing and applying God's Word to our everyday experiences. At the conclusion of today's program, I'll tell you how you can contact McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College. But now, let's get back to Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber.
So early on in this program, Jack, you were saying that we really need to not live on our infatuation in marriage, but we need to live on the commitment we've made to marriage. That marriage isn't about feeling, marriage is about commitment. Were you saying then that in marriage we shouldn't have a feeling of love for one another, that becomes nothing in our marriage?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, let me make a distinction between a feeling that is inevitably going to be there in a healthy marriage, a feeling of deep and profound affection, respect, delight, joy, which is also a fun feeling, I mean, is also a feeling that is enjoyable to have. It's enjoyable to be in love with your spouse. But I really think it's a very, very different feeling than the feeling of eros, infatuation, romance that we've been talking about before. The difference being, I can remember when I was engaged to my wife and I was very infatuated with her. And I was gone for about 3 months during the summer from where she was living and where we had met, away to another state to work as an intern in a church for the summer. And it was just painful to be apart from her. It was like torture. And, you know, when I wasn't busy and distracted, I was just in pain because of our distance. Well, I don't have that same kind of feeling now. It's not painful to be apart from her. I don't have that ache.
It doesn't eat you up inside.
Yeah, it just doesn't destroy me inside or ache inside when I'm apart from her. When I'm in her presence now, it's very, very enjoyable. I like to be with my wife. She's my friend, and it's really a lot of fun to spend time with her. But it's not the same intense, focused. I'm not meeting this deep, intense longing in the same way that I was when I was with her during a period of infatuation. So it would be a huge mistake to think that what I'm saying is, when you're married, you've got this commitment to one another that is strictly business, strictly dutiful, strictly unfeeling, just this rational commitment that you make and you don't feel for one another. I mean, I wouldn't say that for a second. There's a tremendous amount of joy and delight and satisfaction and fulfillment at the feeling level, at the emotional level that will be there in the context of a marriage relationship. But it's deeper, it's more real, it's more substantial, it's more profound. It's not a bubble that's going to burst one day. It's a deep well that is there to stay and is never going to go away as long as the marriage remains healthy. Infatuation is a bubble that can be popped in a second.
It's an insecure bubble.
Very insecure, yeah.
The commitment that brings out this joyful feeling, this deep joyful feeling, doesn't feel insecure. It's the opposite. It feels very secure. It feels very grounded. It has depth. I can reach into it, and there's more to get. There's more to have. There's more to give.
Yeah, exactly. And yet, it's not as intense. It's more gentle. It's milder. It's quieter. It's more subtle. And sometimes we long for that wild, intense, crazy feeling of being in love that we used to have back when we were engaged or, you know, whenever. And that's the attitude that I say we just need to grow up and be more mature about that. That's gone. We're not gonna have that again. We could try to foster it. We could try to have it. It could happen with another person. That's true. But that would be wrong. That would be evil. That would be immoral. And we have to get realistic about that. I worry sometimes when I go into a Christian bookstore and I see books on marriage and there's a chapter. Getting the spark back in your marriage or getting the love back in your marriage or falling in love with your spouse again or something like that. Maybe what they're saying is okay. Maybe what they mean by that is how to work on making your marriage healthy, and in making your marriage healthy, you'll bring some joy and delight back in, and delight back into your relationship. If that's what they're saying, okay, that's worth talking about, that's worth saying. But maybe, I fear that maybe what they're saying is, can't we go back and be in love with each other the way we were when we were engaged, when we were madly in love with each other, when we had fallen in love with each other? Isn't there something we can do in our marriage to recreate that? And to that I say, get real. This is the real world we're living in. That is a mythology and a fiction and a fantasy that we should have no part of if we are going to be mature, realistic, truth-seeking Christians. That's not the way God intended it.
You know, Jack, I'm just thinking about my relationship with my husband as you're talking. And there was never in my relationship with him this strong sense of infatuation. In fact, it's something that I really missed having. I wanted to have it and thought that there was something wrong that I didn't. I think I became really addicted to the drug of infatuation, as I look back now. And I wanted that really strong, intense, I guess I want to call it excitable feeling. It's a high.
Yeah.
Very much so. With other boys and young men that I dated, it was very much there. And I felt like I was really missing out on something. And I was wrong about that. And I wish somebody had this discussion with me way back then, 20 years ago, and said, you know, you're not missing out on something. This is just not a component of what God's giving you in this relationship now. I started out not so much because of my own nobility or good choices, but more because of my husband's, be really being committed to loving me and me responding to him being very committed to my best interest. And I really wanted that. I wanted to be involved with somebody who really, truly did care about me, even at the expense of himself, even though he ended up having to suffer a lot through our relationship early on.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Christine, because although I do think that infatuation does have a role to play in human experience, I don't think it's an essential or necessary role. And you remind me of the fact that there are a number of people who get married responsibly, maturely, and enter into a healthy lifelong marriage who were not infatuated in the way that we've been describing, that was not a part of their coming to that decision. And that's perfectly all right. I don't think there's anything essential about that. And you are right to point out that you really didn't miss anything because of it. Your marriage relationship is none the poorer for not having begun that way. I mean, we have to keep this in perspective. If I'm right that infatuation is a drug and that there's a high that comes from that, what if I never experienced that high in my entire life? No big deal. I'm hopefully never going to experience a heroin high in my entire life, and my life is none the poorer for it. And in fact, my life is probably a lot better off for not having experienced it. A high is a high, and that's all it is. There's no reality to it. There's no substance to it. There's no depth to it. There's no profundity to it. It's not what human existence is all about. That's what's wrong with drugs. It's what the Bible calls dissipation. It's a frittering away of my life. It's a throwing away of my life. My life is supposed to be a series of opportunities to be a glorious person, glorifying God, demonstrating the values, the substantive values of God's own character, God's own person, and God's own kingdom, and to display those in my life as I encounter various opportunities through life. If I just spend my life staying high, what I'm doing is throwing all of those opportunities to be godly away and just feeling good. Is that what my human existence is all about, is to just feel good? There would be nothing more pathetic than just imagine a human existence where I plug myself into a machine and the machine monitors my bodily functions and feeds me and gives me oxygen and keeps me alive and makes me euphoric for my whole life. And I spend 90 years of my life being euphoric. If we don't see that as a pathetic picture, then we really have a radically different view of human existence than the biblical view of human existence. And yet, so many of our attitudes act and behave as if that picture would be heaven. That would be heaven itself, to have nothing but euphoria 24 hours a day for 90 years.
Well, Jack, I think that's exactly how our culture says we're supposed to live our lives. We're supposed to try and feel good.
Yeah.
Most of the people, or many, many people that come in for counseling, tell me what their goal is. They want to be happy. Well, that's what the culture says they should be. And it really comes as a very big surprise to people that that's not what I'm going to give them, is a feeling of happiness. But what I'm going more toward is a sense of what's real, what's true, what's good, who is God. And what does he mean in your life? And how does that manifest itself in your life? But that's a radically difficult turn to take in our lives. It was a radically difficult one for me to take, knowing that I wasn't just going to get to feel good, but I was going to have, life had a lot more meaning to it than that. God has set me up on a course of learning some things, and that's the course I need to be on. I was saying earlier that I didn't start out with any kind of euphoria in my relationship with my husband. I really wasn't infatuated and felt like I had missed a lot. I've come to realize that I didn't at all. I wish that I didn't know a lot about the infatuation, quite honestly, that I nurtured in my relationships before, because it really made me feel like I was missing out on something and pressing Larry for something that wasn't right for me to press him for, and feeling like I was missing out on something that I really wasn't. not in an overall sense of what life is about. I have come to want to focus on different things than that now and seen life very, very differently. But it's taken actually many years and a lot of heartache to get to the point that I am right now. What I experience, though, now in my relationship is very much what you described in your relationship with Jody. It isn't an infatuation, like the excitability of infatuation, like being eaten up if I don't get to see Larry. But when he's gone, I do feel like I really, really miss him. Mm-hmm. I want to see him. I long to see him. And when I meet with him again, there is kind of a little bit of a giddiness. Mm-hmm. It's not the same giddiness that I used to feel in other relationships that was huge and overwhelming. But in a sense, it fills me up more. Do you understand what I mean by that?
Yeah, I think, yeah. Because it's rooted now in something real, in history. It's rooted in a commitment in a relationship, not in a fiction that I have invented in my mind. So it's so much more substantive than anything infatuation ever gave us.
And now, I think one of the reasons I grew out of really wanting this infatuation was because it got replaced by this other thing that is better. Yeah. As you're talking, I think people could think, as we're talking, people could think, gosh, you know, this infatuation thing, why should I ever not go for it because it is so great. Well, I would say to people, don't go for it because there's something greater than that.
Yeah, right.
There's something much better, and it doesn't come out of going for the feeling, which is that infatuation is what we're doing. When I'm falling head over heels in love with somebody, I'm going for the feeling. When I end up with this more substantive feeling after years of marriage till commitment, I haven't gone for the feeling. I've gone toward loving another person.
Yeah.
Committing myself to their best interests, understanding them, seeing them, doing the hard work, with that often involves a great deal of suffering on my part, a great deal of deprivation, a great deal of having to face into the reality of my own selfishness. It comes through that kind of difficulty. But it's better. Is it worth it? I'd say, yeah, it's worth it, if that's what you want your life to be about.
Yeah.
If you want your life just to feel good, then the suffering that is required to come to this other depth of feeling won't be worth it to you. And perhaps that's really a mark of a Christian. If I only want infatuation, then perhaps I'm not looking towards something that's bigger and more substantive and with a greater depth of understanding of what life is about. But if I'm willing to go through the suffering of life and come out with something that has a depth of feeling, perhaps that's saying a big thing about my commitment to my relationship to God.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's exactly right. Your point is a profound one. I've often thought of infatuation as being in love with it, loving love itself, being in love with love. It doesn't really make a whole lot of difference who the other person is. As long as there's a chemistry there that allows me to be in love, that's what I want.
That allows me to feel good.
that allows me to feel that feeling. Whereas the marriage commitment is loving a person. It's a person on the other end of of my attention. And I'm committed to that person as a person. The delight and the joy follows from the working out and the establishing and the forging of the relationship of commitment to that person, and then the joy and the delight follows. And you're right, I think it's much more substantive, much better in the long run. But the child of the devil, the one who really does not want what God wants for human beings in this life, is going to prefer the quick and easy and more economical and more efficient infatuation than the hard-won joy of marriage.
Mm-hmm. It's the most difficult thing we ever do, to truly love another person. And it is the most profoundly substantive one.
Well, let's break for a few moments. Jack and Christine will return in a minute. Christine Barber is a licensed marriage and family therapist. More than that, she is a woman committed to knowing and applying the truth of God's Word to everyday life. She has spent years working alongside others as they discover the truth of who they are and then try to pursue life with love and wisdom. Dr. Jack Crabtree is a philosopher by training, a Bible teacher, pastor, and professor by profession. If you spend a short time with Jack, you quickly learn he is a seeker of truth and a man with a deeply passionate love for God's Word. For years, he has studied and taught the Bible at churches in California and Oregon, as well as the McKenzie Study Center in Eugene. Both Jack and Christine are convinced the Bible is the true Word of God.
In this last hour, we've talked about how do you get to know someone of the opposite sex while you're a single person. We've really focused on an age group that's 20 and older, approximately, not really talking about adolescents who are in relationships with each other. One of the main things that we were talking about was if we're in a relationship where I am feeling entitled to or like I own your time, your space, your commitment to me, then I'm really in a quasi-marital relationship, and that's wrong. I should only be in a marriage relationship when I've truly made, with my mind clear, a commitment of marriage. Apart from that, I'm not married, and I need to not act as though I'm married. What that does for me, though, I think that the psychology behind it is, if I'm kind of in a quasi-marriage relationship, then I'm kind of taking out the risk of somebody rejecting me. And I'm giving myself, on the offensive, an opportunity to be really connected to another person and have my emotional need for not being lonely, for being connected to another person met. I am not then trusting God for my emotional needs. What I'm doing is I'm trying to take the risk out of my life so that I feel good rather than possibly face into some kind of deprivation that I might have to if I'm not deeply connected to another person and kind of owning them, feeling like, you know, I'm not going to have to live without them or spend an evening alone.
And I think that what we were trying to propose instead was forging the sort of friendships toward members of the opposite sex where I really commit myself to doing right by them. I mean, looking out for their best interests, being good to them, trying to be someone who will encourage them toward growing and developing in their relationship to God and in their obedience to God and so on. That's the firmest and surest foundation for any future marriage anyway. You described your own experience and how Larry got to know you and supported you and was a good friend to you. And that became a very, very solid foundation for your eventual marriage. Much better foundation than the sort of thing that we could ever hope to lay down in a so-called dating relationship.
And lastly, we talked about how do you decide who to marry? And you were saying, Jack, that we don't decide who we're going to marry by, you know, figuring out who the very best person in the world is. God actually does have a person that he chooses for us. But what I need to do is ask myself the question, can I be a loving person toward this other person? Can I be married to them in a kind of commitment that God is asking of a married person? If I can say yes to that, then yes, this is a person I should and can marry. And I work out all the obstacles of marriage throughout the rest of my life.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541 1-800-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.